So, as I mentioned at the beginning, my name is Carrie, and I know there are many of you who I haven't met. And I've never given a talk with people behind me before, so that is something different to practice with. Anyway, hi. Okay. But I have been involved with Seattle Insight in various ways and forms, since 2003. Sometimes more involved, sometimes a little bit more removed, but in many ways it's feels like one of my spiritual homes, one of my kind of like my family of origin in a way. So I'm very glad to be offering teachings on Monday nights a little bit more often this year. I also lead the under 40 group on Wednesdays and meet with a lot of people individually. So still feel very interwoven into this sangha. And tonight and this year we are exploring the qualities of heart known as the parami. Right. So, how many people have attended a talk at Seattle Insight since the beginning of the year, and so have some idea about the parami? Wonderful. Okay, and if you don't, that's also great. The parami are 10 beautiful qualities of heart. I think of them sometimes as like our inner natural resources and strengths. Much like sometimes we have to, it's a beautiful poem I was just reading on retreat. Sometimes we have to reteach a thing its loveliness, that poem by Galway Kinnell. Sometimes we have to reteach and remember these kind of strengths and capacities of heart that we possess, that are inherent to us, but that easily get overshadowed, neglected, forgotten. Right? But the paramis are qualities that we are, even though they're inherent, we're encouraged to remember them, but also develop them. So they're I think of them as kind of maturing factors that help ripen us. They're forces of character, so they have a lot to do with how we are in the world, but they also help ripen our minds for letting go, for awakening. Okay. So I'll talk about that a little bit more tonight. I like to start with some stories. So as life has gotten busier for me as a parent, I have a 10-year-old, and I used to spend long time, when I would give talks before becoming a parent, I would spend long amounts of time researching, formatting, getting the gist of things just right, researching quotes, meticulously putting things together. And once I became a parent, often I'm kind of holding a question around the thing that I am investigating and exploring with a group, and kind of asking life, like, okay, show me that. Yeah? Show me what that means. Show me how that gets lived out. How does that get expressed? What, so kind of volleying it to life. Like, show me what that quality is. Right? So I was doing this style of preparing once during COVID, towards the end of COVID, with my Vashon Insight group. And it was along the lines of the paramis, in particular, this virtue of sila that I'll talk about tonight. And it was another day in which I had, my time for preparing had evaporated. I had set aside a few hours, and it turned out that my son's hamster somehow became terminally ill, right? and was like on death's door. So I ended up spending those hours waiting outside of the vet's office on Vashon in my car, because we weren't going inside at that time, with this hamster Yoda in the back seat of the car, panting and not doing well. And so I was opening up my awareness. Like, what is this quality of sila? What is this quality of wholesome conduct? What is this virtue? And as my gaze kind of went to what was around me, I saw this handful of amazing people working at the vet's clinic in the rain, coming back and forth to people's cars, and people in their cars would hand their beloved pets out the window to these vets, who would go in, do the tests, take care of these animals, and then come back in the rain and hand them back. Yeah. And there was so much sensitivity and heart in that exchange. So much treasuring of these little creatures, both in like offering them up in the way that they were being attended to and then received back. It's like, these are hearts functioning well, right? These are hearts functioning well. And I felt such a sense of kind of uplift and inspiration around that. Just like, this is what it means to truly value one another. This is one example, yeah, of what happens when we care and we tend and we value things. So it was a real, like, in the moment teaching for me. So then it was hospice for the hamster after that. But it was very much a teaching. We need examples of hearts functioning well. Right? So I did a similar thing this weekend and kind of considering this talk as well. And someone sent me a video of John Stewart. Maybe some of you saw this, but it ties in. So the host again of The Daily Show, comedian, who spent several minutes, I just saw the clip, but spent several minutes talking about the passing of his beloved dog. Right? So maybe some of you saw this. He talked about going with his children to the animal shelter to get the dog when his kids were young. And this dog had been hit by a car and was at 1 year old and only had three legs. And he talked about the way that his kids and this animal shelter had cared for this dog and how much love had been poured into it. And as he was talking about this, he was openly almost weeping. Uh-huh. Um, and So reflecting on these 12 years of caring for this animal and what that had meant to his family and bringing it to work and how that had impacted other people. But he was letting his heart break openly on air. It was so moving to watch that. Again, I had a similar feeling. This is what it's like when a heart is functioning well, right? Loving deeply, caring, tending, and being willing to be kind of open in that way. Trusting the functioning of one's own heart. And so people responded so quickly to that, right? This shelter, Animal Haven, I think is the name of it, in New York, was inundated with donations, right? So within a few hours, and he wasn't asking for donations, he was just telling his experience of love and care. And they got, probably by now, tens of thousands of dollars, maybe more, supporting them. So people's hearts just leapt up in response to that. That heart, right? That heart functioning well. So I want to talk tonight about the spirit that is behind the precepts, right? Or the heart of sila, which is this quality that's sometimes translated as virtue. It's sometimes translated as ethics or morality. I like to talk about it. I've heard Gil Fronsdell and Ajahn Suchito both use the word ethical sensitivity. So I like to think of it that way, as ethical sensitivity, but also responsiveness or action. So it is the capacity that we have to feel our kinship with others, our inseparable connection with others, to feel sensitive to the impact of our actions in body, speech, and mind on our own well-being and on the well-being of others around us. Right? So it is this moral sense or ethical sense is innate. We have it. It shines forth when we feel safe, we feel a sense of belonging, we do not feel afraid, right? This kind of ethical sense or mutual sense starts to shine forth. So I want to talk a little bit about kind of, because sometimes sila gets confined to the precepts, right? These ethical training precepts that we take as part, as our ongoing commitment, part of our ongoing commitment to community, to keeping all of our hearts in that experience of safety and openness as much as possible. So I want to talk about kind of what the spirit is beneath those precepts. Right. A little bit more about that sensitivity. And the reason I started with these stories is that I think it's imperative that we recognize in this kind of inquiry what Rebecca Solnit, the writer and activist, calls moral beauty. Yeah, there's a certain kind of moral beauty when we're not just, there can be a deep skillfulness in kind of just doing what we're told and doing the right thing and sticking to the program. But to see kind of the capacities of the heart fully functional and operational, there's a kind of beauty to it that we respond to. So to get a sense of that is very helpful. Again, seeing our hearts functioning well and responding well. So another way that we can think about sila is a sense of integrity, which feels like congruence or alignment. So sometimes we're invited in these reflections on ethical sensitivity to be aware of our actions of body, speech, and mind, right? An awareness that those are, all three of those are intimately connected. So what we do in our action with our bodies arises from what is happening in our minds, and our heart minds, and also arises from how we talk to ourselves about what is happening. Yeah. What comes out of our mouths, our actions of speech, have a lot to do with what's happening in our minds, right? So body, speech, and mind are quite connected. So another way we can experience this ethical sense is by a feeling of congruence. That doesn't always feel good. It doesn't always feel pleasant, but there's a sense of alignment when what we say and what we do line up, right? That commitment, even if we might have thousands of impulses to the contrary, that commitment to our actions and our values being in harmony is that leads to a kind of congruence that we can experience, right? So when we're out of alignment, we can feel it, right? We can feel it. So another one of the paramis is resolve, right? And some teachers talk about resolve as underlying all the others. So in order to kind of have a wholehearted commitment to any one of these, we actually have to have some resolution to remember it. That's where kind of the strength and the sensitivity come together. There can be a kind of firmness around some of these that allows and supports the sensitivity. But it has to start with a kind of valuing, right? So a valuing of this, this particular quality. When recognizing it in ourselves and each other. So virtue, or ethical sensitivity, is said to be the highest of all of the virtues, right? And that it gives, it kind of gives birth to the others. So we can explore that, investigate that, examine that. But certainly as a parami, right? So many of you will remember, if you were here at all last year, that at the end of last year, we spent some time exploring ethics, but as a pillar of practice, right? Also supported by generosity, but as a kind of supporting pillar rather than a kind of virtue or sensitivity. So related in similar ways, but also slightly different. So in this configuration with the paramis, it's balanced on both sides, or interwoven on both sides. On one side by generosity, which I know we're working with last month, and on the other side by renunciation. Okay. So I like to consider this framework as our ethical sense is having two aspects. One that contributes kind of to the well-being of others, kind of more in the generosity side, and one that is willing to kind of refrain and hold in check impulses that are unhelpful and unwholesome, right? So I think of it as kind of having two wings on either side, that which the heart that leaps up to delight and contribute is also an aspect of our ethical sensitivity, and the willingness to kind of refrain or hold back, right? To relinquish that which is no longer helpful, wholesome, skillful. So it's got both of those aspects to it. And as a parami, right? So as perfection or quality of heart, this list, this particular map, is meant so lay people like us, practitioners in non-retreat settings or non-monastic settings, can really use the soil of their own life experience in order to awaken. Right? So we might find it, just today I was noticing this, we might find it very difficult to arrange the circumstances of our life with enough quiet so that concentration and deep penetrative insight can arise in stillness. We might find it difficult to arrange those circumstances, but with this list, like the paramis, we're committed to using the very circumstances of our everyday life. And this is a phrase that we use a lot, daily life practice, right? That it can start to kind of lose its meaning after a while. But a real commitment to asking the question, how can I use these circumstances of my life to develop and grow these qualities that support my awakening? Right? So it's believing that we can use whatever it is that we're in to help cultivate some of these capacities and qualities that are already present. Right. So, and as a parami, it kind of takes us further, right? So it has this, by definition, it furthers our development, our awakening, right? It's a maturing process. So Ajahn Suchito talks about it as a way to cross the flood of our conditioning. So we stand on one shore contemplating maybe the beauty of a quality like integrity or ethical sensitivity. And that enables us to kind of put our foot in the river, fast-flowing river of our conditioning, where we experience so many currents going in the opposite direction. Right? Going in the direction of greed or distractedness or forgetfulness or aversion, ill will. Yeah? A million tides going in the other direction. So we, as a parami, we're able to kind of stand in that current and come to more and more come to the other side, or develop it to a point that it becomes kind of more of a new default setting. Right? So that's the kind of promise of the parami. It's not all smooth sailing. It's kind of forged in the fire of our daily life and our conditioning. Okay, so sila, on the generosity side, it's said that when we keep the precepts or investigate the precepts, which are these commitments to non-harming, to really investigating our impulses to take life, to take what isn't given, to work with our sexuality responsibly, to work with our patterns and reflexes around speech, and to watch our impulses to consume. Yeah, things that intoxicate. So it's said that these five, when we undertake these as practices, that we give others the gift of freedom, right? We actually contribute to the well-being and the freedom of others, right? Freedom from danger, you know, feeling afraid, feeling oppressed, feeling animosity or resentment or ill will. So in our kind of consideration and practice of these precepts, we give other people the gift of greater freedom and safety in our presence. And we can feel that. Yeah. So think of these, especially these first three parami, generosity, sila, ethics, and renunciation, as kind of an interpersonal triad, right? Of really allowing our hearts to be sensitive to the way that we are in relationship and in community. So they really kind of set us up in kind of right relationship from the beginning. So giving other people a gift of freedom, or thinking of it that way, knowing how it feels when we feel like we're in a place that's safe, when we're in a place where mutual respect is a value, is upheld, and that kind of sensitivity is fostered, how we feel in such a place. Can be a great motivator to help give others that same gift of freedom. So these three, but especially this ethical sense, creates a kind of field of practice we can feel. You know, sometimes when, so some of us have had time on retreat. And if you've been on retreat, it's like even, you know, animals are coming up a lot tonight. I'm not sure why, but even the animals seem happier, right? In those settings where there's a commitment to non-harming. And maybe we can feel it in coming into a place like this where people have practiced, have contemplated, have at least talked about intentionality and a commitment to wise relationship, wise action. Maybe we can feel it. Yeah. That there's a different kind of almost field texture in the air. So we can contribute to that, and we can benefit from that. So the spirit behind our ethical sensitivity or our taking of the precepts comes from two what are called bright guardians of the world. Right? These are two also qualities of heart that are said to be functioning in every healthy and wholesome mind state. And it's said that when these are functioning, there is kind of harmony, right? There is an environment of wholesomeness. And when they're weak, when they're not functioning, there is a lot of danger, animosity, fighting, kind of a decay of the moral fabric, right? So these two, many of you might have heard of them, are called Hiri, right? And Otapa. So sometimes talked about as bright guardians of the world. Right? They actually guard and protect our good hearts, right? Our deepest kind of well-being. And so Hiri is the sense of conscience. So sometimes it's translated as conscience. And we can recognize it when we feel a certain kind of agitation that is concerned with whether or not we've caused harm, right? So it's a certain kind of unease. I talked about it earlier as a lack of, when we feel out of alignment, this is our conscience operating. There's a kind of unsettledness when we feel like perhaps we've gone against what it is that we most value. Right? So it's often said that kids, at least to a certain age, express a certain kind of morality, right? Inherent morality or concern. You know, concern for others, a sort of innate concern for the well-being of others. But there's this point sometimes early on where they discover how to lie, right? Maybe you've seen this. And in the beginning, they can't do it very well, right? So watching my son and his friends like discover lying and trying to lie, and there are like these words coming out, and it's almost like this look of like, you know, they're trying to like trying to get away with something. Like, am I pulling this off? But often there's such a transparency in that, and you know, a kind of unsettledness until they can make it right, right? So I know that that has come up often in my parenting, watching something deeply, knowing my son is deeply unsettled by something, and just waiting for that hiri or that conscience to be vibrant enough, unsettled enough to kind of come clean, right? We can sense that, not just in children, but in ourselves, right? That's that, as a functioning of our conscience. So this hiri is, sometimes talked about as, a helpful kind of remorse and regret, right? So it's a kind of remorse and regret that that stays with just the action itself, right? It doesn't start to conclude anything about a bad or an errant me, right? So it stays just with the behavior. So it allows us to learn. So when our conscience is functioning, and we have that sense of unsettledness, maybe we said something that wasn't quite what we meant, wasn't quite in alignment with our intentions. Maybe we exaggerated or embellished or lied or lost track of our intention in a situation. And there'll be a kind of unsettledness afterwards that has a certain feel to it. So this is said to be actually a helpful functioning of our conscience. If we can notice that it's not a reflection of who we are at the deepest level, right? So as distinct from a kind of shame, right? I did this and therefore I'm bad, right? I told a lie, I hurt someone, and therefore I am bad, right? This is debilitating. So this is a kind of unskillful or unhelpful remorse or regret that has a bad me at the center, right? The kind that can look clearly at our own actions as perhaps being out of alignment, unskillful, having a harmful impact, and can make an adjustment, right? That is deeply helpful. Then it's a guardian of the world. So hiri is that sense of conscience, concern about my own action, and concern is, or the conscience is how I'm falling out of alignment with my own integrity and values. And the concern is a kind of trepidation for how I might impact others, right? So I really want to distinguish this, the healthy version versus the unhealthy version. A lot of us can feel a lot of kind of shame over our own actions and behavior, and dread over how we might impact others in the future. These are not guardians of the world as they're meant. This is not our functioning conscience and concern. This leads to a lot of self-recrimination and debilitating paralysis, right? So, the spirit that's behind our precepts is a very clear-eyed and compassionate examination. When am I out of alignment? When is there a healthy ability to see where I may have contributed to harm and own that, make adjustments? And where is there a healthy caution behind where I might impact others in the future? Right? So trying to distinguish between the healthy versions and the paralyzing, self-recriminating versions, right, that have each instance of, could say, harmful action be some proof of a deficient or sinful me, right? So we see this over and over again in conversations around race, right? So owning our, when we're endeavoring from very skillful intentions to own some of our sensitivities and vulnerabilities around having constructive conversations around race, it's very easy for those to go sideways, as many of us have experienced. If every time we sense some kind of harmful action as being an indicator of an unworthy me, it's very difficult to continue those conversations, you know, with deep feelings of shame and dread. So, if we can stay with this functioning of conscience and concern, which is a natural capacity when we live in community, impacted by other beings, when it's freed out of that self-contracted sense, it can function a lot more clearly and resourcefully. Yeah. So then these guardians can function. Okay. So I was, again, as I was driving here, reflecting on this and the spirit behind the precepts, I came across a board outside of a church as I was driving by, and it said something like, the Bible is filled with stories of people getting it wrong and God forgiving them. Or God, I can't remember the exact phrasing of it, of people getting it wrong and God loving them anyway. So it's very easy in when we talk about ethics to see it in terms of original sin. Yeah. Even if that isn't our religious conditioning, to somehow think that it reveals this kind of original sin. In the early Buddhist teachings, there are one whole section of the early teachings is devoted to these training rules or precepts that were kept by monastics, but they were made up, I like to remember, they were made up of instances in which practitioners, monks who were living in community after the Buddha's time, were trying to get along well and having a hard time doing it. Yeah. So they were made up of very real foibles and misdeeds. So there are wonderfully precise and practical reminders, you know, of people, you know, not coveting what another person has, right? The robes that somebody else has. Not, you know, ways that people would put rice or different food into their bowl, being very cautious with that. Because people had done that carelessly and created a lot of harm in the community. So I like to think of the Vinaya, or the rules for living in harmony, as they arose out of people getting it wrong. Yeah. People kind of being human and accidentally getting it wrong. So, so it's helpful to think of the precepts, and as lay people, we are mostly committed to just examining these three, not out of any sense of like blind obedience, right? But of really noticing what contributes to my own kind of long-term well-being and happiness and that of others. So this is the generosity side. And what aspects of my behavior lead in the direction of harm for myself and for others? And we have to have a kind of open-eyed, rigorous kind of honesty around that, right? So in the 12-step traditions, so much wisdom around that. There's the endeavor of taking a kind of searching and fearless moral inventory, right, of one's actions. Now, where have I created harm? Where have I caused harm? We have to be able to bear that, yeah, to notice that, to own that, but to also, in a very precise way, learn from that. So our commitment to the precepts is a very practical, but also skillful honoring of that beautiful heart. As one teacher says, protecting, this comes from the early texts, also protecting our sensitivity, protecting our virtue is like a hen sitting on her eggs. It's important to protect this, nurture this, recognize the spirit underneath which these training precepts arose. So there are times in which the precepts are very helpful flags for us, right? Oh, I made a vow, a commitment to be aware of my speech, to watch for my harm in speech. I made a commitment to not deliberately take life. Yeah? So they can be very skillful boundaries or flags, arenas of investigation, yeah, as a way of protecting or honoring this heart in ourselves and others. So, I'll just offer one quote, and then I'd love to hear a little bit from you. So, this comes from Eddie Hillesum, So many of you will know of her, but she left beautiful writings. So she was in her early 20s at the time of the Nazi occupation and was writing in Amsterdam at the time leading up to the war, and feeling this urgency in her writings of keeping her heart alive in the midst of just unimaginable forgetting and cruelty all around her. Right? So she left this wonderful writings and journals of her own experience, trying to keep this heart alive and this valuing of this shared we sense that is at the heart of our ethics. So even as she was brought into a camp and with the knowledge that she would eventually be transported out of that and would likely die, there was this intensity around keeping connected to the heart that was in connection with all other beings. The bright qualities that were very much at risk and overshadowed, but still present. So she wrote, "I shall try to convey to you how I feel, but I'm not sure my metaphor is right. When a spider spins its web, does it not cast the main threads ahead of itself and then follow along from behind? The main path of my life stretches like a long journey before me and already reaches into another world. It just is as, it is as if everything that happens here and that is still to happen, it is as though I had been through it already and am now helping to build a new and different society. Life here hardly touches my deepest resources. Physically, perhaps you do decline a little, and sometimes you are infinitely sad, but fundamentally you keep growing stronger. I just hope that I can be the same for you and all my friends. We need it, for we still have so much to experience together and so much work to do. And so I call upon you, stay at your inner post, and please do not feel sorry or sad for me. There is no reason to." My deepest resources, stay at your inner post. So let's just sit quietly for a moment. So, thank you for your attention tonight. Hope this gives you a little bit of food for your own inquiry and contemplation. So next week we'll go into kind of how to take one of the precepts as an inquiry or as a point of investigation. But tonight I really wanted to just speak to kind of the spirit behind the precepts. So I have some specific prompts for you to take into your week if you'd like, but I'd like to hear first if there are any kind of comments, reflections, your own sense of this. Yeah, please.
I know we just started the Sila of the Parmi of Sila, but I was reflecting on generosity and its relationship to patience. Oh. I was wondering if you could speak to the kind of relationship between generosity and patience.
Well, first of all, it's wonderful to, as you're probably already getting a sense, they all interweave and support each other. Like all good Buddhist maps, they weave together and support each other. So a wonderful place of inquiry is like how two qualities might go together and support each other. So generosity and patience might be a whole nother talk, right? But we might start with one, like generosity, that impulse to kind of offer to the well-being of others, right? And then if a quality like patience comes in, you know, there are endless opportunities for patience everywhere and for generosity, but we might see how those two come together and support each other in our daily lives. It's beautiful when the heart's generous. We also have to be patient with every instance of impatience, with every instance where we're incited to act reflexively, quickly, to favor efficiency, right? Whenever our need for a particular outcome or to, you know, to get to a certain place outweighs our intrinsic motivation to be generous or giving, that might be our place of practice, right? So I think as we go, as you go into any one quality deeply, you'll see that others are available for you, but others are also strengthened at the same time. Yeah. So, our ethical sense, this, sila is the wings on either side. It can be interwoven with any of the qualities, or really this generosity and renunciation, right? So I think of it as the contributing side. Some people might have seen the different versions of the precepts that talk about not just a refraining, but a contributing. But it is also the willingness to refrain. So in that, there's tremendous patience that's required in that refraining. Yeah. It's, so Ajahn Sucitta says, this patience is being willing to take all the time in the world to let things be just as they are. So more on that when we get to patience, but love to hear any, thank you for that. Also appreciate that. It's helpful to go, helpful to go where we're drawn.
So I really appreciated you putting it in the way that the couple of things that affect your sense of ethics and integrity are your desire to be generous to others and your desire to refrain from doing some things that might come naturally from like less of a great place. To me, a third thing came up as I was listening, and it's kind of the biggest barrier that I find towards, like, I really value my sense of integrity, but I feel like it's buffeted by these forces of, like, little evils where, like, I am under the control of someone else who, you know, whether it's at work, you know, really mostly at work, where, like, I don't really have, you know, there will be consequences to having, acting in a way that is, you know, in line with my values. And so I wondered if you have any advice to those of us who are like lacking in the courage department as opposed to kind of the desire to do better.
I loved your question. Could people hear it at home? Great. Okay. First of all, the sense of being buffeted by forces that might be challenges to our integrity. Anyone have a sense of that? Being buffeted by forces that maybe threaten your sense of integrity? Yes, I think we can all relate to that. And it's part of the practice of parami. So not to kind of think that, oh, I've done something wrong when we feel that, right? That sense of being buffeted. And, you know, Ajahn Suchito in this book that I know Tim and Tweri have recommended, ways to cross life's floods. You know? So that buffeting is like the flood of conditioning, you know, that's can come at us from the outside and the inside. But we need a combination. I was pointing to this in the guided practice a little bit of kind of sensitivity, but also strength. Yeah. Sensitivity and strength. So the sensitivity is what in us senses what would be helpful, what would be right, what would feel like it's in alignment, but also that kind of strength comes from a resolution, which is another parami. And it's not a resolution that is kind of, it's my way or the highway or, you know, take it or leave it. It's a kind of resolution that keeps that heart in mind. Right? It's not so much imposing my belief system on someone else and expecting that they follow or demanding control. It's really staying connected, staying committed to being connected to that heart. Right? And we need to be willing to bear some, praise and blame around that. Potentially some disapproval, some disruption around that. Right? So not just talking to you, talking to all of us. So that's the kind of strong back, open front, open heart. Right? But the courage comes from deeply valuing it. Yeah. And when we deeply value it, we want to, protect it, maintain it. So we might not have much control over what other people do, but as is often said, we have a lot of control over kind of the inner environment of our own heart and mind. So we can stay dedicated to that, to knowing what supports that, what strengthens that, what allows that to be healthy and functioning. And what detracts from that? Yeah. So, hen sitting on her eggs. Good. So, thank you. Thank you very much. Good. Okay. And I know this is not easy. I will leave, I promise, we'll leave more time for our discussion next week. And I'd like to talk more specifically about how we can take up one of the precepts as an inquiry. But for just prompts or for your own investigation this week, look for instances of moral beauty. Look for instances of the heart functioning well. Yeah. We have to kind of prime ourselves to notice because the moral injury is so obvious and the buffeting is so obvious. But prime yourself to notice what are instances of moral beauty? People keeping the precepts maybe naturally. Yeah? Or people supporting one another in a generous way, contributing or refraining. You also might look at areas where remorse and regret tend to pool. Yeah. And see that as functioning of your own moral heart, but check it so it doesn't evolve into self preoccupied shame and dread. A helpful kind of remorse as getting you in touch with your wish to not cause harm. Yeah. And your learning around that. Okay. So those are two areas that we can investigate, and both are important. So moral beauty and these guardians of the world. Okay, thank you all. Take a little bit that's useful. I'll see you next week. Thank you.